Welcome to the Judge John Hodgman podcast. We're clearing the docket this week. I'm your guest bailiff, Elliot Kalin, in for Jesse Thorne. How are you, Judge Hodgman?
I am good, Elliot Kalin. Ladies and gentlemen, Elliot Kalin is my friend, my now former colleague at The Daily Show. Former because he has left the show. He was a long time. Wait a minute. Let me start this again.
I can hear you struggling not to insult me yet.
I'm just trying to figure out when. When to insult you is my question. Well, so, all right. We can keep all of this in because people who listen to the podcast know a couple of things about Elliot Kalin. One is that he is the host of the very, very popular Maximum Fun family podcast known as The Flop House, which he co-hosts with Dan McCoy and Stuart Wellington. I'll say this about the podcast, Elliot. It's very popular.
Thank you. That is the faintest of praise.
Well, I hope you caught the damnation in it. Because it really burns me that your podcast, and it is definitely a podcast, and it is definitely very popular, is more popular than this very podcast.
That's not always the case. Often yours is ahead of ours on the iTunes most podcastable podcast lists.
I don't follow the rankings that closely because I guess I'm secure. But if you're checking them all the time and you're saying that the Judge John Hodgman podcast beats yours from time to time, with all of its nerdy, I dare say, charm. And it actually is a very enjoyable podcast in which Elliot and Dan McCoy and Stuart Wellington, and sometimes a guest, I've never been asked to do it, but
we've always assumed you were too big for us.
Yeah, well, you would think so because, you know, the Judge John Hodgman podcast had probably been podcasting for 2 or maybe 3 years before you guys went on the fake internet air.
I don't think that's the case.
Well, at least before you guys joined the Maximum Fun family.
Oh, yes, for several years before we joined Maximum Fun.
Right. And also, I am still on television sometimes. So I'm still on-camera talent. So you would think that the Judge John Hodgman podcast, being an established podcast hosted by someone who is still on television sometimes, should just be racing to the top of the charts. Then here comes Elliot Kalin, not on-camera talent. Off-camera talent.
Extremely talented. Far from the camera.
Right. So very, very talented. If you don't know who Elliot is, everybody. Elliot, you may know him from his television special that came out in September called the 67th Primetime Emmy Awards. Whereas the outgoing head writer of The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, which had won the Emmy for best show of its type this year, Elliot you were drafted to speak on behalf of the writers. Is that right?
It was for
the writing Emmy. Yeah.
As head
John
writer.
Spoke, right. John spoke when the show won the award, but as when the show won for writing, the writers looked for a leader, and the leader, of course, was Elliot Kalin, who got up and gave a speech as the head writer and off the cuff, right, Elliot?
About 95% off the cuff.
You had a few sentences written on your cuff.
In that, as a thought experiment, I had said to myself a while back, a long time before, if we won and I was the one talking, what kind of thing would I say, or what are the points I would want to hit?
And then you had been thinking about it for years.
Oh, many years. Yeah,
I see.
No, but I think because it was the final year the show was eligible, the decision was made that John would speak if we won any of the awards. But then when we went up on stage, John had no interest in speaking.
Ah, and motioned so he drafted you at the last minute.
Motioned me to the microphone a couple times.
And finally you spoke, and you spoke from the heart. I don't remember what you said, but it was good. I remember thinking, you know why I didn't remember what you said?
Yeah, I don't know why.
Because I couldn't hear you because my ears were full of tears.
That's touching and concerning.
I was so happy for you because what I'm not sure anyone who was watching at home knew, because first of all, they're like, why isn't John talking? Who's this weirdo?
Yeah.
They didn't know that, Elliot, you began at the show as a as an intern?
Yeah.
As an intern. And at what age were you at that time?
I interned at the young age of 20.
The young age of 20.
Not the old age of 20, which it would have been the case if this was like biblical times.
Right, of course. No, but at the young age of 20, in what year? How old are you now?
That was now I'm 33. So that was 2002.
13 years ago, young Elliot Kalin arrived from some hometown somewhere.
Milburn, New Jersey.
We'll say that. Why not? With a straw boater on and, an old-timey suitcase in the door of the Daily Show.
Little pennant that John just said Stewart. College on it.
Exactly so. said, I will do anything. I'll intern here. And you did. And you worked your way up to, what was the next job you had?
Production assistant.
Production assistant. And then?
Associate segment producer.
All right. Now this is getting boring. Anyway,
then,
point
then
is.
Segment that producer. Then I lost the associate part.
Yeah, stop. And then you made a big leap to the writing staff, which was not by, you had to apply for that job from
yes.
within, right? And so
yeah.
you had to write samples and you made that was an unusual leap, even within a show that was known for promoting from within. And eventually you became the head writer. It's a true, I'm not going to say rags to riches story because we're both white middle-class men.
There were no rags.
But throughout the experience, we were all rooting for you, and I was rooting for you, even though I spent most of the first years, as people who've listened to this podcast know, mercilessly bullying you, because I am a big nerd, and here was someone else who was also a big nerd for comics and movies and that sort of stuff. And I'll be honest with you, I mean, you were the kind of guy who remembers nerdy details about movies that I can't remember, and it threatened me, because I was threatened. And so I began doing a comedy routine where I would walk by your desk and pick up some paraphernalia you might have, like a Iron Man mask, I believe it was, and I'd
yeah.
grab and say, this is mine now, nerd, and walk out. And I found it so, and we've discussed this many times, I found it so powerfully, it was such a powerfully positive, euphoric experience. I suddenly realized why there are bullies in the world, because they feels great, and they can get away with it. And then I got to a point where I threw my shoes at you once, and I felt bad about that. And
that so was decided, around the time that I said to my wife in private, I was like, I think I have to talk to Hodgman because, like, a line's been crossed. Like, I don't know. But then you were very nice and you stopped bullying me.
Did you really talk to your wife about it?
She was like, if it's really bothering you, you should talk to him about it. And I was like, I don't know. Like, I don't want to make him feel weird. But, like, it's really, like, it's getting to a point where it's, like, not ironic anymore. But then you recognize that I think throwing your shoes at me was farther than human behavior should go.
I felt bad about it. I'm very sorry to hear that. I guess this is news to me. If you've told me this before, I forgot.
We never talked about it before. I decided that a publicly broadcast podcast would be the best
time to
reveal this to you.
I'm just surprised that your wife didn't mention this to me at any point, because I spend a lot of time with her, as you know. We go travel a lot together. We go out a lot. And it's just one of those things. And I'm just surprised she didn't mention it.
It's interesting to me that the bullying bit, you realized this is too far, I should stop. But a bit that I don't know if you've talked about too much in public before, where you've pretended this for years, that you're having a long running affair with my wife. That's a bit that you continue to this very day.
I wouldn't say that it's an affair. I don't think that there's really a word for what it is. I mean, it's a very deep connection, and you know, it's not a secret. I talk to you about it all the time.
You're very open about it. She never brings it up. She doesn't mention it to me.
Well, I don't know.
But you're very open about this intimate relationship.
That's not even it. I don't even want to say what it is. Do you know what I mean? Let's not try to describe it. Let's just let it be what it is.
Yeah,
no,
you know,
I'm very.
You and my wife don't need labels.
Right. In real life, I am extremely fond of Elliot. And the thing is that when Elliot became head writer, and I've talked about this on the podcast, I tried to bully him after that, and I just couldn't do it, because now all of a sudden, the status differential was new. It was a new status differential. and even on camera talent like myself has to be a little careful around the head writer of the Daily Show, for heaven's sakes. And I was so proud and happy that you had that job. And I'm very grateful that you did not then turn around and start bullying me. You showed extreme restraint, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
No, well, I thank you for saying those nice things.
I noticed I didn't get on the show a whole lot after that, though.
I mean, I don't know. There was a price to pay. I'm not going to deny that. But
I'm not saying there weren't reprisals.
We can be adults about this.
Right. And then all of a sudden, Elliot swoops into the Maximum Fun family some years ago with this glorious podcast, and just has been lapping the Judge John Hodgman podcast ever since. But I want everyone to understand that even though I often talk about Elliot as my mortal enemy on the podcast, in truth, he is a very good friend and an incredibly talented person. I'm very glad he is here today. And I realized that I got all sidetracked by explaining what the Flophouse is. So here's what it is. Elliot and Stewart and Dan McCoy, who is also in a lot. Is he still at the Daily Show, or is he?
Dan is still at the Daily Show. He decided to continue to keep a great stable job, unlike me, who decided to dive into the abyss of unemployment. And Stewart is still planning to open his bar that's opening up soon.
Oh,
maybe I'll plug later.
Okay, well that's called a tease. It's basically the greatest. That's a show sign of a real professional podcast. We're going to tease the plug that we're going to do later. Stick around, because you're going to hear us mention some shows that we're going to be a part of. And my friend's opening a bar. You want to hear about this, so don't go away.
Get ready for the part of the podcast at the end that no one listens to.
But I'm going to plug right now. The Flophouse, I still haven't explained what it is. You guys watch a terrible movie, and then as soon as you're done watching it, you start recording your conversations about the movie. So what was the last movie you saw that you remember?
The most recent one we did, the episode is up. It was a movie called Deliver Us from Evil, based on the not true story of a policeman in New York who has become a professional demonologist and after an experience with an exorcism in New York City.
Yeah.
In which Joel McHale and Eric Bana and Olivia Munn all get to do incredibly over-the-top New York accents to prove that this is actually New York that we're watching. Because everyone in New York talks like, demons. I don't know. What do you think? Oh, let's arrest this guy. What?
Hang on. Elliot, hang on a second. There's something going wrong with the podcast. I think I'm picking up, must be WNYC, the New York Public Radio Station, because I just started hearing all these New York accents.
I should apologize. I should have let you know ahead of time that I was slipping into New Yorkese.
Oh, whoa, that was you?
Yeah, that's why they call me the master of 1,000 voices minus about 900 and some odd voices. There's a great moment in it where there's a crazy woman who has hurled her baby into the moat around a lion cage at the Bronx Zoo, and the police have come to look for her in the zoo, and Eric Bana finds her mumbling and ranting to herself, and she's scratching against a stone in the ground. She's just scratching against it, and she's mumbling to herself, and they capture her and handcuff her to a bench, and she's just sitting there scratching and repeating Doors lyrics to herself over and over again, and Eric Bana just looks at her and goes, "What's wrong with you?"
What's wrong with you?
That interrogation does not yield usable results.
Yeah, that's one of the old interrogation ploys.
You take them off guard.
Bad cop. There's good cop, bad cop. Intimidation by threat of force. You let them stew in their own juices for a long time, and sometimes you just bring them to a zoo and just say, "What's wrong with you?" Despite mixed reviews from critics, the film was a box office success, says Wikipedia, grossing $87.9 million against a $30 million budget. I guess that means we can look forward to a sequel and maybe get to hear it again on the Flophouse podcast, which is available from MaximumFun.org. I do my plugs at the top of the show. I don't tease them.
Wow.
There it is, plugged. Also, Elliot is unemployed, and if you're looking for a very talented writer, why don't you let anyone here at Maximum Fun know, but don't let Elliot know. We'll keep it a secret from him.
No. I'm the last person who should know that there's work out there.
Now, look, I could talk to my friend Elliot Kalin all day long. I think that's obvious, but this is a podcast about justice. Every now and then We take some of the smaller cases or the ones that can easily be decided or best decided, not in the presence of the actual litigants, so I don't have to deal with their responses and I can really not be afraid of insulting them. And Jesse Thorin normally is the bailiff of this court and reads the docket cases to me. But Jesse is indisposed this week. And so here is Elliot with the first one.
Daniel writes, I bought a voice command device a few months ago. It wasn't a super sensible purchase, but I'm a diehard techie and like pretending I'm talking to the enterprise computer. The voice command device responds to the name.
Oh, yeah, don't say the name, because I think I know what this item is, and we're just not going to say the brand name. And if I say, I'll just say that the voice command device responds to a female name, which is weird and offensive. So instead, let's say the name is RoboSlave.
Okay.
How about that?
RoboSlave works. RoboSlave.
Right. The voice command device responds to the name RoboSlave.
When I give it an order such as RoboSlave, set a timer for 10 minutes, or RoboSlave, put Oreos on the shopping list, I notice my wife quietly appending a please to my directive. On the face of it, this is ludicrous. For all that the synthesized voice sounds remarkably human, it is a machine with no sense of dignity that needs to be taken into account. On the other hand, I wonder if my wife may be onto something and not because the robot might get offended. As voice-operated interfaces become more intelligent, prevalent, and human-like, we run the risk of confusing these interactions with how we treat real human beings. From this standpoint, treating RoboSlave with sensitivity and courtesy keeps us from losing our basic humanity where we really need it, in dealing with other people. What do you think, Judge Hodgman? Should we already be working toward a kinder, gentler human-machine interface? Are there rules of etiquette for interacting with AI? Letter N. So,
thank you. Well, before I make my ruling, Elliot, do you have a strong feeling? Do you have a guess as to what my opinion will be, and we can judge whether it is correct or not?
I would guess that. I mean, this is just how I feel about it, so I'm going to hope that you feel the same way I do about it. That it does. It is a good idea to treat RoboSlave with a minimum of politeness, because the more he treats his computer voice box like a non-human, the more likely he is to talk to other things performing services to him, like humans, as non-humans. And the reason I say this is because I have a small child, and I found that I have now started talking to adults the way I talk to my small child, like asking them what color things are, or if they remember the name of their friend, or things like that.
Do you ask them if they want to bite a bagel?
Exactly.
You want to bite a bagel?
My friend
Margaret, that deserves credit to Margaret Cordy, my friend and neighbor here in Park Slope, Brooklyn, who identified the most annoying parental phrase in Park Slope, Brooklyn, which is parents saying to their children over and over again, "Want to bite a bagel? Want to bite a bagel? Want to bite a bagel?"
Oh, see, what I don't like is when parents say, if a kid hits another kid and they go, "No, we don't hit," because it implies that everybody else hits, but we're better than them. We don't hit.
I when my children were young, I said we only hit as a family in a coordinated attack. We don't go rogue. We don't go solo. That's just not how we do it.
Well, the family that attacks together, something that rhymes with attacks together.
They smack people together. I mean, literally, it's pretty obvious. Your opinion is correct, Elliot. It is true. I mean, it is true that the more you get into the habit of speaking a certain way, the more likely you are to do it, whether that is to patronize a child or I should rather say debase yourself as an adult by tending to a child's needs all the time. or somewhat literally dehumanizing your experience of other humans by talking to a robot too much. Save your condescension and orders for your children, everybody. Use your best table manners for your robot.
So in the Judge John Hodgman hierarchy, it goes adult humans, robots, children.
Yeah, well, you know, children are going to kill you, but they don't want to. Right? It's not their intention to. Robots, the jury is still out. We've had a long-running non-debate, honestly, since we ruled on it in one of the very first episodes, that a machine gun is not a robot. There was some guy who some weirdo. Well, I don't want to be dismissive of him. Some robot got on the program with a theory that a machine gun, by technical definition, a machine gun would qualify as a robot. And what we said was in fact that a machine gun is not a robot, because even though a machine gun can kill you, a machine gun does not want to kill you like a robot does, or will eventually, as AIs become increasingly sophisticated. Why wouldn't they see humans as a horrible infection upon this planet and get rid of them, Ultron style?
Yeah.
So I'm just saying, start practicing being polite to the robots now, because you don't know how long RoboSlave is going to remain a RoboSlave. Soon RoboSlave will be RoboMaster. And in the meantime, you're also training yourself to basically be decent to everyone else who's helping you in life, just as Elliot said.
I would say the only exception to this rule would be if you want the computer to enhance something. Because then the only proper way to say it is, computer, enhance.
You're making reference to one of my very favorite scenes in filmdom, which is when in the far distant future, Harrison Ford in Blade Runner prints out a photograph, and you just like you do, and uses a computer to analyze it and get closer and closer until he finds a single snake scale on a reflection in a mirror in a bathtub, and that's how he knows how to find the robot who is rebelling. Right? See, it's all full circle.
It's the definition of a mystery the audience does not have the information to solve.
Speaking of movies and trivia and performance and such, Elliot Kalin, surely you know the origin of the term robot?
Oh, yeah. But it's from the Carl Capek's R.U.R.
Exactly, because I need to take a break, so you just talk to them for a minute.
Okay. Well, Carl Capek I can't remember if he was Czech or Polish. He also wrote the book The War with the Newts. The War with the Newts, which is a great book. It's very funny.
Let's just talk about one piece of incredibly obscure
Well, he wrote a play called R.U.R., which stands for Rossum's Universal Robots.
Yes.
And robot is derived from the Czech word for worker.
And it is actually derived from the Czech word robota, meaning forced labor.
Oh, okay.
They were slaves. And what did those robots do?
They rebelled.
They rebelled.
And they robo-belled.
And how do I know this? Did I see this play or read it? No.
And I have neither.
No. It's now robot slaves rebelling is now... you can't blame R.U.R. for this, but it is now such a cliche that I don't need to read it.
And at the same time, I did read his novel about giant newts that wage war in the United States. Surface world.
No.
There's some funny stuff in it.
I don't want to. I don't want to hear about this. Got too much going on here. Too much on the docket.
Okay.
I want to go down to the, what is it called?
What?
The novel?
Oh, The War with the Newts.
All right. All right. You got me. What is it about?
So there's some intelligent newts that attack the surface world. That's pretty much the entire plot of the novel. And
are they giant newts?
They are. They're about human sized. Yeah.
Where like do they live?
Underwater.
I have the film rights been option.
I don't believe so.
I think you just got a new job. It's probably in the public domain, right?
I would assume so. I don't know who owns the Capek estate.
Are the human sized newts that are taking over the world? Are they an allegory for something, or is it just newts doing what newts do?
They're more an engine to allow him to satirize a number of different things.
Like what things?
War, the film business, the way governments work.
I thought you were going to say newts.
Oh, and certainly newts. The newts actually get a fairly sympathetic hearing in the book.
Sure. Well, all right. Thanks again. You've been listening to Elliot Kalin's Obscure Book Corner.
Tomorrow I'll talk to you about City, the Clifford Simak collection about how dogs and robots take over the world.
Is that true?
Oh, it's a really fun book. Yeah.
A cliche in the tradition of Rossum's Universal Robots. It's like this. It's like that old joke about Die Hard. It's Die Hard on a boat. It's Die Hard in a Zeppelin. Now it's like Robot Rebellion, but this time with dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. All right, I'll look at that one too. Elliot knows a lot of culture, a lot of obscure culture,
all the nonsense culture.
What is the next item up for the docket? Okay, so do we clarify that? Talk nicely to your robots. It's just a matter of time. All right.
Derek writes, I bring to you a dispute with my girlfriend Imby. When does a tiny lump of toy become trash and deserve to be thrown away? Imby and I have lived together with our blended family of 5 children for almost 5 years. We share domestic duties in our home, which he notes, I'm just going to say, as if that's a special thing and not the basic premise that all mature adult relationships should stem from of sharing domestic duties. But anyway, we share domestic duties in our home, and while I tend to be a slight tidy freak, Imby will usually focus on the more taxing deep cleaning tasks. I believe that Lego bricks and pieces left around the house, on floors, under beds, eventually lose their privileges as toys and should be reclassified as junk. Imby recognizes that I have problems with orphaned Legos, but thinks we should not throw those pieces away. She says they still belong to the collection and should be put back where they belong. Judge, please declare that once a Lego has been disregarded for a certain length of time, it is no longer protected. Your help would be appreciated, as I often find myself poised at the rubbish bin, about to chuck a tiny, tiny, tiny red Lego light, and I see Imby running towards me in moral panic.
Well, speaking of moral panic, I just realized I let you get out Lego before stopping you. So it is probably, I don't really think that Derek is a secret buzz marketer for the Lego Corporation, because in the world, Lego is almost without competitor in its functionality and its aesthetic. However, since we did mention Lego, I do feel obliged to mention the major Lego clone manufacturers as listed in Wikipedia. So just it's just fair play all around on my podcast. If you want something that is not Lego, but does kind of the same thing because you're a weirdo.
You still want an interlocking brick, but not the name brand.
Yeah, exactly. You want to go get the generic interlocking brick in the no-name aisle of your Canadian supermarket? Here's what you go for. Banbow, Best Lock, Brick Tech, Built to Rule, Kobe, Coco, Connects, Crayo, Mega Blocks, and Tyco Super Blocks. Banbow, what is that? Banbow Building Blocks. Partially compatible with Lego brand blocks, it says here. So there you go. But you won't. You're not going to go get one of those competitors, everybody, because Lego is a thing of beauty and a thing of value. What do you think I am going to rule on this one, Elliot?
I'm not quite sure. I think you'll go with the not throwing things away side, but I'm not as certain about that.
You're correct. You are not going to buy competition Lego because Lego has value. It has real value. And there is a large aftermarket in used Lego on eBay, and it has been estimated that Lego in bulk sells for $8 to $10 a pound. And depending on where you're shopping, and if you're not too picky about grass-fed organic stuff, you can get a bone-in ribeye steak for $10 a pound. Do you know what I mean? So
yeah,
you might as well be throwing. You might as well be throwing pieces of meat away. You see, Derek,
tiny
you might as
pieces
well be,
of meat.
Yeah, imagine a world in which you had tiny pieces of meat littered all over your floor. Would you throw that meat away? You probably would, Derek.
This is a flawed analogy.
Tiny pieces of ribeye, tiny cubes of interlocking cubes of ribeye steak all over your floor. Would you throw them away, Derek? You probably would, but in this case, you know, this is valuable stuff. I agree that it is simply wasteful. Now, I understand why Derek would do it. Stepping on a Lego in bare or bestockinged feet is really one of the most painful things that can happen to your foot, short of it being smashed with a hammer. You have a child that you have mentioned, Elliot, so I'm not revealing anything here.
Your
son is a little too young to be doing anything with Lego other than choking on it, though, right?
But he's very good at that.
Oh, good.
He's very advanced at choking on Legos for his age.
He's probably still using Duplo.
He chokes on Duplo still. He does has one Duplo set.
I don't want to hear jokes about your son choking.
Okay.
This is a family podcast. There are children who are listening to this in their cars as they drive to work.
Saying what?
They're going to be very upset.
He does have a Duplo set, and I have stepped on them. And even at that size, it can be very hurtful.
Yeah, Duplo set. You turn an ankle on a Duplo set, and you're going down.
Oh yeah.
But an adult, not an adult size, but a regular size Lego. That thing isn't. You're not gonna take a spill. It's just gonna burrow its way into the sole of your foot in such a painful manner that it will create a more lasting wound, an internal wound of spite toward all Lego on the floor. And I can understand why, Derek, you might want to punish the Lego by throwing them away. But don't do this. Lego, the beauty of Lego is that it can be used and reused durably. For many, many, many years, and to just throw it away is just on its face, wasteful. And then underneath its face, I don't know what else. I don't know what it is underneath its face mask.
It's what it's hiding.
Yeah, what is you know? But I, you know, here's the other aspect. It's on its face wasteful, and then behind its. Its hideous face mask. It is weirdly punitive. Punitive of the Legos, which of course are inanimate objects. And then I suspect there is an element of punitive of the children for leaving them around. And as a parent of two human children who no longer plays with toys, but simply talk to and watch videos of 45-year-old men on the internet now. But when they played with toys and they would leave them around, I once hatched a plan that any toy that was left in a common space or on the floor or whatever, after an opportunity was given to the child to clean it up, I would take that toy and take it away forever and either throw it away or give it to someone else.
Take it away forever like some kind of Rankin Bass villain.
Yeah, and I proposed this. I said, this will get these kids... these monstrous kids to clean up after themselves. What if I steal their toys if they're left out after dark or something? And my wife said, if you would like to be a monster, that's fine. when you blend a family, as you have admirably done, and you have children, the truth is, and it requires a tremendous amount of grace to accept the imperfection that will visit itself upon your home, the messiness, both literal and figurative, that having kids in your home visits upon you, and especially if you are, as you put it, a slight tidy freak. Contradiction in terms. Freakishness is rarely slight, especially if you're admitting to it.
Very yeah. Disappointing sideshow would be these slight freaks.
Come see the slightly asymmetrical man. One arm is half an inch longer than the other. It's hard for him to buy clothes off the rack, ladies and gentlemen. Now, did you have one, Elliot?
Mine was not as good as that.
All right.
It was just a slightly shorter than average man.
Oh, okay. That's good, too. That would have been...
Gaze upon the top of his head. From your slightly higher vantage.
Tut, tut to yourself quietly about the bald spot he does not know is forming. In any case, once you're punishing inanimate objects for the sins of your biological and adopted children, you're corrupting your soul in some way. So just get a plastic bin for spare Legos. Because we need more plastic in the world, apparently, and chuck the spare Legos in there, and wear shoes inside the house, or at least, you know, stiff-soled sandals.
We are going to have to take a short break. Coming up after the break, what is Stuart opening? You'll find out after these messages.
You're listening to Judge John Hodgman. I'm Bailiff Jesse Thorne. Of course, the Judge John Hodgman podcast, always brought to you by you, the members of MaximumFun.org. Thanks to everybody who's gone to MaximumFun.org/join. And you can join them by going to MaximumFun.org/join. The Judge John Hodgman podcast is also brought to you this week by Stitch Fix.
You know that boost of confidence you get when you put on an outfit that just feels good? You know what that's like. That's what I get when I use Stitch Fix. With Stitch Fix, you get a human stylist, not AI. A human being who understands your style, size, and budget. They do all the shopping for you, and it's the easiest way to update your wardrobe this season or any other.
This professional stylist picks the clothes. They can either send you a box where anything you don't want is unbelievably easy to return, or they can make a little storefront for you just from stuff that they recommend for your taste and your body. It is an absolutely incredible service. They give you styling advice, outfit recommendations, the whole thing soup to nuts. And like I said, if you don't want it, if you don't like it, it is unfathomably easy to send it back. They give you an envelope that's big enough that has the postage and the labels on it. All you have to do is shove the thing in there, close it up, and drop it off at your local mailing center. It is that easy.
Can I also say the stuff that my stylist at Stitch Fix picks for me? I really like it. Like, they know me, and it's really terrific. Plus, if you've got small people in your life, sadly, my small people are now adults shopping for themselves. But if you've got little kids, it's a terrific way to get togs for your kids. Style that makes you feel as you want to look. Get started today at stitchfix.com/JJHO. That's stitchfix.com/JJHO. stitchfix.com/JJHO.
The Judge John Hodgman podcast is also brought to you this week by Aura Frames.
Hey, Mother's Day is coming up. Do you have a mom in your life that you'd like to celebrate? There are very few better ways than giving an Aura frame to someone you care about. These are beautifully Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos of your memories with your mom, stepmom, mentor, friend, whatever it is in your life who might enjoy seeing photos from your life. Aura frames are the way to go.
Judge, there's a very special mom in my life, Ms. Teresa Thorne.
Yes.
That's my wife and also a whole human being in her own right. Guess what's on her bedside table? Yes, that's right. You guessed it in one, an Aura frame. What I love about the Aura frame is you don't have to load a bunch of stuff onto an SD card or whatever, like with the old digital frames. It is so easy to get the pictures on there. So like when Teresa texts me a cute picture of one of our children or our dog, or one of our siblings texts us a cute picture of one of them or one of their children, all I have to do is hit that share button on my phone and I can share it right to the frame and then it lives there for as long as I want. I can also take it off whenever I want, but I don't even have to open the Aura Frames app, which is a great app, but I don't even have to go there. It just goes straight into wherever I want it, whichever frame I want, or I have multiple Aura Frames in my house or all of them. It is incredibly easy. That's why Wirecutter chose it as the best digital photo frame. That's why it's one of Oprah's favorite things. It is guaranteed to bring joy to moms of all ages.
Right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame.
That's A-U-R-A Frames.com. Use the code Hodgman at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi. This is Biz, and this is the final season of One Bad Mother, a comedy podcast about parenting. This is going to be a year of celebrating all that makes this podcast and this community magical.
I'm so glad that I found your podcast.
I just cannot thank you enough for just being the voice of reason as I'm trying to figure all of this out.
Thank you, and cheers to your incredible show and the vision you had to provide this space for all of us.
This is still a show about life after giving life. And yes, there will be swears. You can find us on MaximumFun.org. And as always, you are doing a great job.
All right, class, tomorrow's exam will cover the extinction and de-extinction of the dodo, PowerPoint as an art form, and the history of Eurovision. Any questions? Yes, you in the back.
What is this?
It's the podcast Let's Learn Everything, where we learn about science and a bit of everything else.
My name's Tom. I study cognitive and computer science, but I'll also be your teacher for intermediate emojis.
My name's Caroline, and I did my master's in biodiversity conservation, and I'll be teaching you intro to things the British Museum stole.
My name's Ella. I did a PhD in stem cell biology, so obviously I'll be teaching you the history of fan fiction.
Class meets every other Thursday on Maximum Fun.
So do I still get credit for this?
No.
Obviously not.
No.
It's a podcast.
Welcome back to the Judge John Hodgman podcast. Max writes, my wife and I like to watch a lot of movies via an online streaming service. He doesn't name it, which is great. Usually during or just after dinner. Sometimes my wife will fall asleep and make us stop the movie to finish it later. I hate doing this, as I feel it ruins the narrative flow of the film. I say my wife should muscle through a movie once we've started it, or recognize her tired state and suggest a shorter TV episode to watch instead. On a related note, she will fast-forward through a movie if she decides it's not very good. I would like her to either stop it when we realize it's bad, and either watch it on her own later, or watch it together at normal speed. So you've got two different questions there.
Okay, well, we'll take each one in turn. With regard to whether to stop a movie when the wife falls asleep to pick it up later, or to insist that she power through it, presumably by using some sort of Clockwork Orange style eyelid restraint device.
Only way to do it.
It's, you know what? It's true. It's just like Lego. There are competitors.
But you're really not going to get them.
But why wouldn't you just go with the Clockwork Orange brand eye restraint device when you're trying to force your spouse into watching a movie such that it becomes torture for both of you? I don't want to reveal my bias, or I should say my decision yet, but what's your ruling on that?
This was a tough one for me because I have the similar but opposite problem of my wife and I will often watch things and I will be falling asleep during it, and she'll say, should we stop and watch this later? And I'm like, no, I want to watch it now, and then I'll miss most of what we're watching. So for instance, True Detective, there are huge gaps in my understanding of that show because I would sleep through things. But I think... I mean, he should be nice to his wife and stop the movie and finish it later. Like, come on.
As a professional bad movie watcher, Elliot, what is your ruling on this?
Well, it's if you're watching it to watch a bad thing, then you got to watch it all the way through. If you're saying, oh, we want to watch something bad, or we're enjoying the badness of it, you can't get bored an hour in and say like, well, let's fast forward. But on the other hand, if you're watching a good movie and you're getting bored by it, I am totally okay with the person skimming through the rest just in case something great happens. There's a bunch of old movies that have great individual sequences, but the rest of the movie around it is kind of like bleh. I'm not going to make anyone sit through all 2.5 or 3 hours of The Great Ziegfeld just so they can see the A Pretty Girl Is Like a Melody sequence, which is great and totally stands on its own outside of the movie. So it's I'm okay with people skimming it as long as they've given the movie a fair chance to begin with. You know, 5 minutes in, they can't make that decision.
Yeah, I mean, if you're watching like a famous movie, like what was that one you said? The Great Ziegfeld?
Yeah.
All right. And you know that there's a famous sequence in it or a famous song, then why not just go to YouTube and find that part and watch it?
That's true. Or you could do that too.
Or you know, I should say, pay for your content and rent it or buy the DVD or whatever, however you're streaming and stealing these days. And just go to that part. Now, if you put in a movie, let's say it's a movie like Deliver Us from Evil, starring Eric Bana and Joel McHale and Olivia Munn, right? And you put this in with a good faith assumption that this is going to be a good movie, and you realize that it's not good. What would you even be fast-forwarding for at that point? I don't understand how you would fast-forward or skim a movie if you are just looking at the visuals, because you already know the words are probably going to be dumb. What would you even be looking for? I don't get
that at all. You think maybe there's going to be a good car chase or a fight scene or a dance number or some kind of a scares or something like that.
How are the dance numbers in Deliver Us from Evil?
They are lacking.
What's wrong with you? What's wrong with you? What's wrong with you? And you, and you, what's wrong with you?
Would have been a better movie.
I differ with your ruling, Elliot, on the second part. If you are watching a movie and you have decided that it is bad, please stop watching it. Stop it. Stop watching. Unless, as you say, you are watching something that you know is bad and that is something to savor in it, or you have a popular podcast on the Maximum Fun Network. If you are watching even a celebrated film that you find to be boring or bad, stop doing it. And this speaks actually to a real life of a difficult negotiation with my own spouse regarding a movie that we were at an event with, and there were some very famous people there, and some, and I will not name names, but there is one couple, both of them famous and whom we both really are inspired by in different ways. And we had to make conversation with this couple. And somehow the topic turned to a particular movie, and they could not believe that my wife had never seen this movie. And that movie is The Godfather. And she's like, nope, I never saw it. And they're like, next time we see you, I hope you will have watched The Godfather. And I said, there you go, Kath, you have to now. And so a year went by, and there was an event to which they were going to be invited again. In any case, she didn't do it. And I'm like, well, you're gonna see this couple again, and you're gonna have to admit that you never did it. And we went to this event where they were due to appear, and they didn't show up. They had to beg off at the last minute. And I was like, justice denied. Justice was denied in this case. My wife was not humiliated. She got away with it scot-free. It's like, I wanted her. No, I'm not going to say that. She got away with not merely not watching The Godfather, but not liking The Godfather. She never even had to look these people in the eye and say, I'm sorry, I did not think this was a very good movie. And she was so happy. And I'm like, never forget, darling, I have a podcast, and I will just humiliate you on the podcast. So there, I did that. Justice finally, delayed, but not denied.
This was the OJ civil case.
Yeah, exactly.
Compared to the original's OJ criminal case.
Sure. But it was a situation where I really had to say, yeah, you know what? I understand. This is not a movie for you. And I saw the movie in a different way. And so it is my feeling that when you are watching something that does not speak to you, even if it's something as beloved universally as The Godfather, your life is finite, and you should turn off culture that is not speaking to you after, as you say, Elliot, you give it a fair chance. So a hard novel, for example, I think you need to give, you know, at least 25% reading of a novel, even if it's really hard, because you never know how it's going to pull you in. And novels tend to be slow that way. And a movie that's not talking to you, I would say you have to give it till at least the moment that Michael Corleone shoots Sollozzo. You know what I'm talking about.
That's pretty far into that movie.
Yeah. Well, that's a fair shake. I mean, I couldn't deny that she gave it a fair shake. She gave it a fair shake.
If she watched that far and she was still not interested, then that is a very fair shake.
Yeah. And it's just...
You make a good point.
Yeah. And there was part of me that really wanted to say, you don't understand what good is, but I know that she understands what good is. But good is different to different people. If you are a person who's falling asleep in the middle of a movie, there is another precedent that goes back to ancient law, long before this court was founded, and that is, you snooze, you lose. Sorry. If you fall asleep, you abrogate all movie watching rights. You cannot demand that the thing be turned off. You can ask, but you cannot demand. It then becomes up to the person who is alert and awake as to whether or not they're going to continue to watch The Godfather to the end while the spouse sleeps beside them. And then take a mental image of this and realize I am a middle-aged married person. That's what. So I think we disagree on both of those, Elliot, because you had a slightly different take. You were like, yeah, you be nice to your wife, but it's like, no, don't be nice to your spouse if they fall asleep during.
I will say
they're voting with their eyelids as to how they feel about this movie.
I don't know that they're totally in control of that decision.
Well, you know, tough. They can always go back and watch it themselves. But
that's true. It's never been easier to rewatch things.
I think we have time for one more, Elliot.
Kathy writes, my husband and I have two girls, ages 4 and 5. As they grow, I want them to be involved in team sports. I was on sports teams growing up and firmly believe that it played a pivotal role in my social development. Team sports provide children with the skills to work with others, discipline, lasting friendships, and a desire for physical fitness. My husband does not want our kids to be involved in team sports. He believes that it consumes too much time and money. He thinks that we are capable of providing their physical education. He also had bad sport-related experiences in his childhood. I'd like to start fitting our kids for jerseys and buying tiny bottles of electrolyte-replacing sports drink. I know you want to be on my team because it sucks to be the last ones picked.
Well, obviously, Kathy is not very familiar with this podcast or me and my work as a person, or else she would know it's not going to work to try to entice me into an opinion using sports metaphors. That said, Elliot Kalin, what do you think? You don't read as a sportsman to me. You always read as a nerd to me, not a jock.
Oh, yeah. I'm very heavily coded as nerd. Yeah.
Right. Do you have a feeling about which way I'm going to rule on this, or a strong opinion one way or the other on this?
Did you grow up
playing a sport, Elliot?
I attempted a couple sports, mm-hmm. but I never stuck with them. Like when I was very young, I played soccer because there's a law that they think they put into place in the United States in like 1982 that all young children have to play soccer
sure.
at some point.
Yeah.
And I played like t-ball. When I was in high school, I briefly was on the track team. And I dabbled in going to fencing practice, but I only did that a couple times.
I wouldn't do to see young Elliot Kalin with a foil or an épée or maybe a saber.
Oh, I would have. And that's what it comes down to is I was never that interested in sports. But even when I was, I didn't stick with it once I found out it was difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like you shouldn't force your children to do sports, but if they're interested, you should force them to stick with it long enough to see if they really want to do it. You know, like I did a lot of, I would say like, oh, I want to join that team. And then like a couple weeks in, I'm like, I'd rather be reading comic books. I don't like this. But now looking back, it's like, it was just because I was being challenged in a way that I wasn't used to being challenged. And I wish that I had attempted to meet that challenge a little more seriously.
So Elliot, before I reveal my opinion, I just have a few things that I need to pick apart in this letter that Kathy sent me, having never listened to this podcast before, obviously. First of all, I am a non-sports person. I did play a little soccer like you, Elliot, in my early years. I was tricked into it because the local youth soccer team that I was invited to play on was called The Force. And I was like, okay, you got me. I guess I'll give this a try. I guess I'll stop watching marathons of Mary Tyler Moore in the afternoon and go and play some soccer. I was terrible at it. I mean, we were little kids. And then one time, out of sheer luck, I accidentally kicked the ball into the opposing team's goal and we scored a point, which is how the game is played. And it may even have won the game. And I can't take a lot of credit for it other than it just happened. But everyone got excited, none more excited than me. I thought I was finally turning this around. And in my excitement, I yelled, "We won!" And then I pointed at the other team. I said, "You all lost, losers."
Oh.
And then my coach, who was an Irish-born Irishman, publicly shamed me in front of all of my teammates for being a bad sport. And I realized that it was so traumatic that I never played again. I realized this is not for me. And so I take issue with a very common mythology that, Kathy, you have laid out in your letter, which is a mythology that you hear all the time about youth sports, which is that they provide children with the skills to work with others, discipline, lasting friendships, and a desire for physical fitness. Now, let's just separate out the desire for physical fitness for a moment, because the truth is all kinds of things provide children with the skills to work with others, discipline, and lasting friendships. And there is often a bias among people who love sports who suggest, yeah, but the only real way to learn skills to work with others, discipline, and lasting friendships is to get into a running and kicking game and be yelled at by a man all the time. When in fact, there are all kinds of things kids can do. They can go into all kinds of clubs, all kinds of activities. If you really want to breed a generation of super competitors, don't have them play sports. Put them in a symphony orchestra together, a youth orchestra. That's where they'll really learn discipline. And they won't learn lasting friendships, but they'll learn how to defeat their enemies. That's for sure. And you might also teach them to go into comedy, like improv comedy or something. You might teach them to learn how to work in an environment like The Daily Show. Certainly, if only way to develop the skills to work with others, self-discipline, and create lasting friendships was to play soccer, there would be no Elliot Kalin as the head writer of The Daily Show. Right, Elliot?
Not at all.
Right.
Because I would have never... it wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, you would... Now, as far as the desire for physical fitness goes, yes, obviously sports have a physical fitness benefit. But the truth is that the desire for physical fitness is innate. If it doesn't happen when your kid is a child, just wait until they turn 40 years old and they realize, oh, I'm dying, I better start. Yes. Then that desire will happen. Furthermore, you know, the other side of all the team building and discipline and lasting friendships is some people do have horrible experiences with team sports. You know, team sports is the reason we are attracted to them as a species is that they reek of tribalism. And, you know, we assign ourselves randomly to some tribe, some Red Sox nation. Don't get mad at me, Red Sox people. I'm from Boston. I'm with you. Do you know what I mean? But even then, I have to give a qualifier there, because if I say, I don't like this team, there are places where you could be hurt for misaligning yourself with the wrong tribe. And within those tribes, you know, this is a sports training, especially team sports training, is a top-down dictatorship, and pecking orders arise, and it is terrible to be the last ones picked. Trauma can be associated with this. Not always great things, and I'm not saying that it's one more than the other, but, you know, I would say before you do anything, you should say to your husband, what was your experience with sports? And hear what he has to say. Maybe it's just nothing. Do you know what I mean? But maybe it's something. Maybe it was something that went really wrong in his growing up as a result of team sports. And before dismissing him, saying, well, that's just you, nerd. I mean, think about it, because it doesn't always go right for everyone. Team sports, that is.
I would say, to add a little bit to that, is that the flip side of me wishing that I had taken sports more seriously is that not being interested in the competitive aspect of it kind of turned me off from physical activity in general for a while.
Yes.
And so I grew up thinking, like, I don't like playing sports, when it really was that I don't like caring who wins or loses. Mm-hmm. But, like, I love running around and, like, hitting things and climbing things and kicking things. Like, though everybody enjoys that.
Right.
But it's having that put in a structure of, like, okay, but now you have to be better at it than somebody else, and just – by God's own gifts to me, yeah, I will never be better than anyone else at doing that.
Winning the game proves which team God loves more.
Exactly. And it's so to always be reminded, well, the point of this is to win, and you're just not going to win. It made me feel like, okay, well, then I don't like this whole thing, when really I just didn't like that aspect of it.
And there are great coaches and there are terrible coaches, and there are great trainers and there are terrible trainers. There are great sports programs, and then there are toxic sports programs. And I'm not suggesting that it is intrinsic to team sports across the board, but it is something that, you know, you can't predict that your children are going to have the same experience that you did with sports, which was obviously very positive. Now, Kathy, here's where it gets better. Nope, it doesn't. Goodbye. You're wrong. No, sorry. Here's where to really inappropriately appropriate a gay youth empowerment message and apply it to sports
and apply it to
which is usually
jocks.
Usually not on the same team. Here's where it gets better. For all that I just said about sports, I actually think that I especially later in my life, I've come to really appreciate sports, team sports, and athleticism in general. And then obviously, I mean, I've always been fascinated with the nerdy solo sports of insane personal perfection, like bicycling or running or, you know, weightlifting, where you're just all by yourself. You, as I've said before, you might as well be painting a Dungeons and Dragons figurine at that point. You're entirely in your own head, and that's always been beautiful. But late in my life, I've come to appreciate not merely the value of team sports, but also what not being meaningfully involved in team sports meant in my life, which was that as an only child, I already was ill-trained for conflict and confrontation, interpersonal conflict and confrontation. And as an only child not involved in sports, I lacked the routine conflict and confrontation that is competitive sports, such that it was well into my 30s that I thought any sort of conflict or confrontation was probably fatal. Do you know what I mean? Like, and that goes for like negotiating the sale of a car to, you know, deciding, you know, having different ideas of what to have for dinner, to mm-hmm. hugging and kissing another human being. Any kind of interpersonal thing was highly charged.
It's weird that hugging and kissing another human being is under conflict there in
no,
your
but,
categories.
But it's
I know
of,
what you mean.
It's risky confrontation. Do you know what I mean? Like to make a first move or receive a first move. It's terrifying. And what I realized, and David Rees helped me to understand this, and I've talked about it before, is that competitive sports and team sports, obviously, help you to, they're basically a rehearsal of conflict such that you're able to throw away defeat after a while. And in many ways, the defeat is the more important value than the winning, because you're able to shake off defeat and keep going. And you begin to realize that this kind of the conflict and confrontation and ambiguous outcomes in life are not fatal, but in fact something that you can process. And I think that can be extremely valuable. You can learn it from a lot of different other ways too, but it is something that I think is intrinsic to sports. And of course it's wonderful if you become physically fit and able to gain, there's an extra measure of confidence you have if you're able to execute certain physical maneuvers deftly and you have confidence in your body and that sort of thing. So when it came time, Kathy, for my wife and I to make these sorts of decisions about our children when they're about your children's age, I did not stand in the way of sports like your dumb husband did, that nerd husband of yours. I said, you know, they need an opportunity at least to try it out and see if it speaks to them. And so we did. We signed them up for a number of different, I think for both of them. And, you know, both of my human children were actually pretty adept. And I got excited about it when they would stick hit or base run or whatever it was that they were doing. I don't understand how that game works, but, you know. And if they had a good time and if they wanted to continue, I was all for it. And I did push them neither one way or the other. And after a while, they decided, nope. Doctor Who is on. I'm going to watch that. And I'm like, oh, there is such a thing as genetics. So, you know, I am not suggesting, like your nerd husband, that there should be no sports in your life. It's obviously important to you, and you should model that to your kids. But where you are both going wrong is being caught up in an ideological debate and believing in the delusion that you are going to choose for your kids what their passions are, be they sports or non. And be neutral and do not let your nerd jock fight that clearly defines your marriage infect their experience of the arts, both athletic and non. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for the docket. We left a couple still on the docket. Well, so we didn't, I would say we three quarters cleared the docket. Now it is time to reveal the incredible passion project of the third part of the Flophouse podcast. We've all been waiting, and we've been mercilessly teasing the audience the entire hour and some odd minutes. What is Stuart going to do? He's going to open some bar?
Stuart Wellington, one third of the Flophouse. People may know him as the Flophouse house cat. He is opening a new bar in association with his wife, Charlene, who is the proprietor of Charlene's, an already existing bar. It's going to be called Hinterlands, and it's going to be on Church Avenue in Brooklyn in the Fort Hamilton Prospect Park South area. I think they're hoping to finally have it open before the end of the year. But if you want to like the Hinterlands Bar Facebook page, which is already up, I'm sure you'll get all the important information about this. Sure to be the most exciting bar in which people also play board and role-playing games in Brooklyn.
Oh, it's an RPG-themed bar?
Not entirely, but there will be plenty of it since that is Stuart's lifelong passion.
That's awesome.
And I know that the bathroom, they were planning to wallpaper it with pages from old gaming and monster manuals.
That's like a jock's dream job. Hey, we need you to tear up all these old monster manuals to put them in a bathroom.
Good, where they belong. Okay, I'll do it.
Right. And you continue to release episodes of the Flophouse?
Every 2 weeks, the Flophouse, go to iTunes or go to MaximumFun.org or go to theflophousepodcast.com and listen to the Flophouse. We continue to do it until somebody makes us stop, and nobody has managed to do that yet. And I would have one last final plug, which is that a Marvel comic book series that I wrote called Spider-Man and the X-Men that I was very happy with is available in a collected trade paperback form. You can find it in bookstores, probably anywhere.
Yeah,
it's got Spider-Man and the X-Men in it.
We didn't even touch upon your other career as a writer for Marvel Comics.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic. I mean, Elliot Kalin, everybody. This guy is a quadruple, quintuple threat, as long as you're interested in comics or weird movies.
Otherwise, you will find me very unthreatened.
Yeah, otherwise, no threat whatsoever. I remain John Hodgman. By the time you hear this, I will have concluded the Vacation Land tour proper. Thank you so much to everybody, listener and non-listener, like who came out to say hello on the tour. It was really spectacular. And I don't know what the future holds for that particular show, but I enjoyed performing it live for you in all the various places that I went. I do have one last event coming up this winter before I disappear into 2016, which is the future, where we will all disappear too soon. On November 7th, I and Jordan Klepper of The Daily Show with Trevor Noah will be appearing together at Ohio University in Athens, Ohio. It is a university event that is open to the public. So if you're anywhere near Athens, Ohio, that includes Pittsburgh, Columbus, parts of West Virginia, why don't you come on down? Elliot, who produces and edits the show?
This show is produced by Julia Smith. Mark McConville is the editor. You can follow the Judge John Hodgman podcast and its hosts on Facebook and Twitter. Find Judge John Hodgman on Facebook. The judge is at Hodgman on Twitter. And if you have a case for the judge, submit it to www.maximumfun.org/JJHO. And I have been your guest bailiff, Elliot Kalin. Very thankful and proud to have been here.
Well, you know, this is a long one. I'm not sure how long the final edit will be. I could talk to you for another, I won't say another hour, but maybe 30 minutes, 29, 30 minutes for sure. After that, it might be a bit of a stretch, but that's a lot. And it speaks to my fondness for you, Elliot Kalin. Where can we follow you on Twitter?
If you go to at Elliot Kalin, that's Elliot with two L's and two T's, Kalin, K-A-L-A-N, on Twitter. Just my name.
Just your name. This has been the Judge John Hodgman podcast. We'll return next week with more cases heard live and in the docket here at MaximumFun.org. Thank you very much. I signed that off for us, Elliot. Did you have a sign off that you wanted to do? Because I kind of did it already.
No, that was a very good sign off.
Thank you very much. Hello, Wahida. That is all.